Arvid Lindblad scores points as an 18-year-old on debut.
He's really pushy.
Is he? That's, do you know what? But that's great.
Liam Lawson brutally demoted back to Racing Bulls.
What kind of a man walked through the door at Suzuka last year, right?
His head was down, and he won't thank me for saying this. We obviously knew him from the year before. We could tell he certainly wasn't the same guy.
Lawson will get his best ever Formula One result in fifth.
Don't want to say we rebuilt him because that's a little bit dramatic. We're there to help him, but he made a turnaround.
Hello and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson, and Racing Bull's team principal, Alan Permain. I've known Alan for many years, and I followed his career closely through both the highs and the lows. He tells me in this chat he was devastated when he left Alpine in mid-2023. He'd worked at Team Enstone for more than 30 years, winning multiple world championships with Michael Schumacher and Fernando Alonso. But he also calls it a defining moment in his career, one that led him to becoming a team principal for the first time. A year on since taking that job, Alan explains why the role wasn't a natural fit for him initially, the challenges he's faced and the changes he's made. And he gives great insight into Liam Lawson and Arvid Lindblad and how he manages their wheel-to-wheel racing on track. And he describes the unique way they decided which driver would receive all of the team's latest big upgrade first. Alan's in great form and gives fascinating insight into life at Racing Bulls. Plus, keep listening for your chance to win tickets to this year's Spanish Grand Prix in Madrid. Great to see you. It's been 6 years really? Since you were last on the show.
I think it was in COVID times, wasn't it? We did something in Istanbul. I seem to vaguely remember and chatting for 2 or 3 hours.
And we could have gone longer.
Yes, it was good fun.
Good fun. Well, it's great to have you back on
Thank you, mate.
And we're speaking at Spa-Francorchamps, 12 months on from your first race as TP of RB. I just wanted to start by asking you how you reflect on the last 12 months.
So it was a big step, and I think I've said before, I've certainly said to you, it's not something I'd imagined doing, it's not something I'd had ambitions to do, but it's something I'm loving, honestly. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. There's bits of it that I enjoy more than other bits of it, but I'm also very conscious of the fact that there's 11 team principals, and it's a privilege, it's an honour, and I need to try and enjoy it as well. You know, even when the bits that are not quite so much fun, let's say, I'm trying to make the most of that as well.
You say you weren't expecting it. Can you just take us back to the moment in terms of how was the job offered to you?
It wasn't so much offered as we need you to do this. And
you are doing this, Alan.
It wasn't quite like that either, but it was we need your help. This has happened. Laurent is moving up to Red Bull Racing, and we'd like you to step up to this. And I must admit, I think I've told the story, I've certainly said it to others, it wouldn't have been my first choice of things.
Why?
Because you know me, I'm not one for the limelight. I absolutely shy away from it as in my previous roles as much as possible. And certainly that's one aspect of this job that's been the most, maybe not the most challenging, but it's been challenging, is stuff like this. Doing press conferences, talking a lot with media, talking a lot with sponsors, and not to play it down. I don't want to say that's not difficult, but it's not something that comes naturally. And it's something that I put a lot of effort into. I feel I have to prepare well, just make sure I'm on top of things like that. You know, standing up in front of 800 people who work for us to talk to them, that's something that a year ago put the absolute fear of God into me.
And now?
Everyone said, and I was quite open with it when I got the job, I said, that scares the life out of me. And people said, you'll come to love it. And I don't say I love it, but also it certainly doesn't. It's not something that consumes, you know, a week beforehand, doesn't consume my every thought anymore. And I like to think I'm doing a decent job of it. At the end of the day, I'm trying to give people what they want to hear. I don't want anyone to come to a, a meeting of all, you know, of everyone, all our staff, and feel that, oh my God, we've got to go and listen to him again. I want to try and impart some knowledge that maybe from the track, what we've done, a little bit more of an insight or what's coming in the future, and people to want to come to that. Because otherwise, what's the point?
Now, you've done so many senior roles in Formula One. Just what extra pressures are on you now that weren't on you before?
I think the financial side of it is much more you playing with. I try to see this as an extension of what I've done before. So most of my career has been about finding performance. So whether you're a race engineer or a chief race engineer or even sporting director, which is the big roles I've done. In those roles, you've got, let's say, some aerodynamics, or you've got some suspension set up, or you're always trying to find performance and trade-offs and things like that. I'm trying to use that experience in this team principal role to do the same. It's about finding performance. And again, it's a very simple thing to say. We only really care about two things. We care about going fast and we care about not stopping. So performance and reliability, and those two are intrinsically linked as well. Without reliability, you can't have performance. So I'm now using some different building blocks. Instead of roll bars and front wing angles, it's people and money, if you like, and making sure that we're spending what we have wisely in the right areas, and making sure people have, firstly, that they're happy in their roles and we have a nice working environment, but also they've got what they need to do the job that they want to do. I'm not going to go and tell the head of aerodynamics how to do his job, but I just need to be there to support him and make sure that he's got everything he needs to do his role. And that's how I see it.
And I'm guessing, as well as all of that, you're getting insight into bigger picture Formula One as well in the role as TP. How has the job changed your perspective on Formula One as a whole?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure it has. Yes, I now go to an F1 commission meeting, which is all the other team principals, but I've sat in and that's a very grown up version of the sporting committee that I sat on for many, many years. So it's of course at a much higher level. And at the moment I'm very much at a listening stage rather than jumping in with what, you know, me campaigning for the way that Formula One should be. Whereas I guess when I was in that sporting, I was far more vocal and trying to drive that sporting group, being one of the more senior members in it, let's say. And now I'm certainly one of the junior members in the F1 commission group. So I'm much more in a listening to 90% of it and maybe talking 10% instead of the other way around.
Take us into one of those commission meetings, right? Which of your peers impresses you?
Oh, that, come on, TC. I can't. That's not fair. Oh, okay. They're all impressive in some ways or another. You know, when you look at the big guys, your Totos, Freds, Flavios, those are the guys who are driving that sort of thing, and they're the guys with the biggest investment in, you know, with big teams and engine suppliers. But of course, Laurent as well, and. They're all in their way. Everyone, of course, everyone brings something to that group, and there's something to learn from everyone.
Alan, you've got 30 years plus in Formula One behind you, right? Is there any advice you'd give your younger self, knowing where your career is now, or has it all been useful?
Yeah, my career has all been useful to come into this point. As we said before, I didn't know it was coming to this point. And there's things I would have done differently in the past, I think. But to change anything? No, I don't look back any of it and think, oh, I'd have done, you shouldn't do that or you shouldn't do this. I mean, I've ended up as team principal. Eh? It's gone pretty well. It's gone better than I could have imagined. Maybe there's little specific things I would have done differently, but as a trajectory, it's very nice. I have to say that, and I'm sure you want to touch on it, the leaving Alpine and going not really leaving Alpine, but moving on from Alpine, shall we say, and going to Racing Bulls was a defining moment, of course. And without that, I probably wouldn't be where I am now.
Alan, let's talk about that, because that was another spa moment for you as well. Your last race for Alpine 2023, right here. I remember being shocked. I've known you for years. How tough was it for you?
Very.
Why so?
Because that was my life, you know. Okay, I've got more life than that. I've got a life away from the track, but I'd been at Alpine for 34 years. You know, I started there when I just turned 22. I'd done an apprenticeship, and that was my job after I finished my apprenticeship. I went to work there. I went to work at Benetton, and the team went from Benetton to Renault to Lotus to Renault to Alpine, and I'd been there, and it completely came out of the blue. So I was devastated, really, and it was hard. It was a hard. Certainly, it certainly spoiled the summer break that year. That's for sure.
Did you think about just walking away from Formula One completely and getting involved in another arena?
No, honestly, I was very fortunate. My phone rang that day a couple of times. You know, people saying, what the hell's going on? And let's have a chat and let's have a catch up. And Christian Horner was very gracious. I think in the press conference at Spa, he spoke very nicely about me, which was nice. And he then came and spoke to me on the grid and said, give me a call when all the dust has settled, give me a call.
So Christian was nice. Pivotal in you coming to...
I don't know, because I also spoke with Laurent, who had also been confirmed as team principal for AlphaTauri, as it was at the time. But I spoke to a few other places, and I was very fortunate to have some options. So no, I didn't ever consider anything outside of Formula One. I don't think I could do anything outside of Formula One. I don't know. And I don't think I would want to either. I love, you know, I love what I do. I really enjoy being in this environment and the competitiveness of it. I absolutely love.
But you did have a bit of time out. Any new hobbies in that time?
No, I remember my wife saying to me, what are you going to do with yourself for, you know, she was working. We were in the UK and I remember I think it was the very first day of the Cricket World Cup. And I said, look at the TV. Look, this is day one of 45. So I'm good for the next 45 days. And she said, you cannot sit and watch cricket for 45 days. And I think I did a little bit. I said, look, I need to just do nothing for a little bit and reset. As I say, we had a bit of a miserable summer holiday that year, and bless her, she's been great. She's a massive support. So without her just doing the team principal role as well, she's there behind me and helping me and supporting me in that.
Once you've been institutionalized by Formula One, which all people who have been here for a long time in a way have been, is life outside F1 a little scary?
I don't know. I've not really been outside it. So I'd had those 5 months, but within two, I knew what I was doing. And within 3 months, it was all signed and sealed for me coming to Racing Bulls. So there was a month definitely where it was unpleasant. And I didn't really know what I was doing. And just changing jobs, you know, I hadn't started a new job. So my job when I went to AlphaTauri or Racing Bulls then as racing director was the second job, no, third, the third job I'd ever had, ever. That was scary. That was daunting, going somewhere new, walking through the doors to a new place for the very first time. But again, it's made a little bit easier because it's Formula One. As soon as I walked in, I remember walking through the doors of the it was Bicester. We had a sort of aero facility in Bicester at the time, and straight away you see three or four faces, you know, people you've worked with in the past, people from the pit lane. So that makes it a little bit easier.
This episode is sponsored by Wayfair. I don't think I know anyone who hasn't looked around their home and thought, this room's nearly there. It just needs that one final piece to bring it all together. Then you start looking and everything's either the wrong size, not quite your style, or far more expensive than you were hoping to spend. Well, that's exactly what brought us to Wayfair in the first place. There's so much choice to the extent that I'm still looking through everything on their website and working out what to order. I love all the possible bathroom additions, like the mirrors and the freestanding cabinets. And what about the orthopedic luxury pet bed for the dog? And with the kids all at university at the moment, I love what they call the bed edit for things like duvets, bed sheets and pillows, all of which they need. And what about one of the gorgeous photo frames for the kids to put by their beds to remind them of a special moment while they're living away from home for the first time? There really is so much to choose from. And one thing I really like is Wayfair Verified. Their team hand checks products for things like quality, functionality, and even how easy they are to put together. That's really reassuring when you're buying something online and haven't had a chance to see it in person. And whether you're looking for furniture, lighting, storage, or decor, they've got something for every room in the house. Plus, if you'd rather not put it together yourself, they can even take care of delivery, installation, and assembly. Ready to upgrade your home for way less? Head to wayfair.com right now to shop all things home and get your space ready for less. That's Wayfair, WAYFAIR.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Right now on F1 Beyond the Grid, it's competition time. Formula One is heading to Madrid this September, and we're giving you a chance to be there. Because we have a pair of grandstand tickets for the 2026 Spanish Grand Prix to give away. The winner will see Formula One cars racing at the sport's newest circuit from the Team 55 grandstand, which is going to be filled with fans cheering for home hero Carlos Sainz. The competition is free to enter, and here's how you do it. Go to f1.com/podcast-win-Madrid and follow the instructions and fill in the form. The competition's open to listeners of all three official F1 podcasts, F1 Beyond the Grid, F1 Nation, and F1 Explains. The entry deadline is midnight UK time on Friday, the 31st of July, 2026. And the prize is a pair of grandstand tickets only for the Formula One Spanish Grand Prix 2026 in Madrid. You must be aged 18 or over to enter. For full terms and conditions and your chance to win, go to f1.com/podcast-win-Madrid. Good luck.
Right, let's bring it back to these last 12 months. All of the experience you've just been talking about, how has the team changed since you've had the keys effectively with your experience over the last year or so?
I don't know, really. We have made some changes and I have had to make some changes. They've been a little bit forced. We lost very early on in my team principal tenure. We lost one of our very senior technical people. So had a little bit of a reshuffle in that area. That's when we brought in Dan Fallows to be technical director, whereas before we had two deputy technical directors, if you like, reporting to Tim. Now we just have Dan as technical director reporting to Tim. And that, I think, has been a certainly is working well. Whether it's better or worse, I don't know, but things are working very well in that area. And when I speak to the chief aerodynamicist, who's a super, super guy, he seems very happy in how things are. He's happy in the way that the team runs, certainly his team runs, or he's able to run his team. So I try and let the people run their team. And when people come like that come to me, or I'll give you another example. We had a change in the top of HR, which reports to me. And the girl who's now HR director at the time said, "Oh, what do you want me to, how do you want me to do things? How do you want?" And I said, "I have no idea. I know nothing about HR, but it's more, what do you need from me? So you're the expert. You do that. But if there's something you need from me or something more you need in your department, come to me and then let's talk about it." So I'm definitely not a micromanager, shall we say. And I'm very happy to admit that my life has been at the track, and that's what I know. So there are lots of new things I'm learning, but I don't feel I need to learn. Honestly, I don't feel that's a good use of my time to know about every department that reports to me, to know the ins and outs of that at all. So I'm much rather happy I let people run it and me support them where they need it.
And how would you describe the atmosphere inside the team? How does it compare to Alpine, for example? How different is it?
So Alpine is a tricky one because the last few years were a bit tough. Certainly it was a fantastic place, and I'm sure it's getting back there under Steve now, but the last few years were a bit tough there. I think we have a great atmosphere. You know, you certainly feel it when you go in on a Monday morning after a good result. The whole place is lifted and is buzzing. And I spend a little bit of time in Milton Keynes, but most of my time I spend in Faenza, in Italy, and I try and it's a big place. You know, we're sort of touted as a small team, but it's a big place. There's 600 people there, something like that. So I try and at least once a month get round and have a wander around everywhere and say hello to people and that sort of thing, rather than being stuck in my office, if you like. It's good. It feels good there,
Alan. It's amazing how it's changed. I first went to the team in 1998 when it was Minardi, and it really was just a couple of small little buildings. And now
it is, as you say, it's a bona fide big Formula One team.
Yeah, yeah. And we've just started another big construction project there to expand production with the aim to be able to make every single part that we're capable of making to make in-house. So we can't make a fuel cell, we can't make a radiator, and no teams are doing that sort of thing. But everything else we want to make ourselves. And that's an efficiency. That enables you to make parts faster, enables you to make parts cheaper. It's a cost cap efficiency. It's a sign the team is still growing. I'm incredibly grateful for the support from Austria to enable us to do that sort of thing. And that's one of the things that I certainly didn't appreciate. I appreciate it a bit when I was racing director, but being team principal, you really appreciate the support from Red Bull Austria.
What is the brief from Red Bull Austria? Because, of course, when it became Toro Rosso back in, I think, 2005, it was very much about developing young drivers, even young engineering talent as well.
And it still is.
That is still the brief.
Yeah, absolutely. It absolutely is.
Is that a frustration to you?
No, because I know that's the brief. You know, if you told me I could have Max and Fernando, of course, but I can't, you know, and I know that.
I know, world exclusive.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a frustration. It's absolutely not. And there's definitely a satisfaction in bringing on young drivers. There's certainly one of the very few nice things about getting older is giving experience and help to young engineers. And certainly I'm trying to do that with drivers as well. And I hope and I think we're having some success in that area.
What do you make of, I think it was Zach Brown who was quite vocal a few races back about one entity owning two Formula One teams. I think he was referencing Toto Wolff trying to buy the minority stake in Alpine. Of course, Red Bull has these two teams, has had these two teams for more than 20 years. What's your take on Zach's comments?
Well, you won't be surprised to hear that I don't agree with Zach, funnily enough. Look, I think Zach is doing what Zach should be doing, which is fighting the fight on all fronts. He's fighting on the track, he's fighting off the track, and he's not fighting us, of course. He's fighting with Red Bull there. With our current performance, we're not a threat to McLaren. We're away off them, especially in the race. You see it. There's a very healthy gap, but I think he's doing what he can to just unsettle things, make things a little bit unstable. I think the way he went about it wasn't particularly nice, writing an open letter instead of coming. I'd been super happy if he'd have picked the phone up and we have a chat. He wrote this open letter that had several inaccuracies in it, saying that our staff are leaving with minimal or no notice periods, and that's just not true. It's absolutely not true. He specifically talks about a guy, and it's who I talked about earlier. This we had this deputy technical director, and he's gone to Red Bull Racing and said, "Oh, well, this all happened within a couple of months." It's not true at all. I knew about that in September last year that he wanted to leave and he wanted to go to Red Bull Racing, and I specifically didn't let him leave until I think it was April time, and then he had to serve 3 months gardening leave as well, which is in FIA regulations. So any teams that have a relationship, it's very clearly governed in the regulations what you have to do, and we followed that. So there's inaccuracies there, but I also see it from Zach's point of view. I see what he's doing. You know, no offense taken, but I see why he's doing it. But honestly, to be on this side of it and see the steps we go to make sure that we are operating fairly and within the rules. So to operate within the rules and what we take from Red Bull is, I don't want to say it's a burden because that's not quite the right word, but we put a lot of effort into making sure that we are respecting the regulations and more so than I would have done in a previous team. You don't have to worry about that side of things.
I mean, how different is your relationship, say, to Haas's with Ferrari? Are there similarities there?
I mean, I guess so, because I think they take, and I don't actually know what Haas's relationship with Ferrari, but ours is very much a customer supplier relationship. So we take Red Bull's front suspension, we take Red Bull's rear suspension, we take Red Bull's gearbox. And on the car, that's about the limit of it. And there are a few other bits and bobs, the steering wheel and I think the steering rack, but whatever's allowed in that.
Sounds very similar to Haas, actually.
In that transferable component part of the technical regulations, we're taking. Now, we also share a wind tunnel with them. But again, that is, you know, in a perfect world, if we had a magic wand, we'd have our own wind tunnel. Of course, you know, you'd both have a state-of-the-art wind tunnel, but we don't. And there are certain good reasons to do that in terms of financial reasons. You don't want to build 200 million plus facilities, but it's definitely a lot of effort, a huge amount of effort goes into making sure that those two teams are kept separately during wind tunnel running. Absolutely. And that brings an additional burden, as I say.
And that is the bit that is based in Milton Keynes. It's just aero.
No, not quite anymore. It started off as just an aero design, but now we have it's aerodynamicists. It's our model shop is there, but we also have some full size car design there. We have some race engineers there. We have some strategists there, and I think we got two sites, and we're trying to use the advantages, any potential advantages of that. So if someone particularly wants to work in the UK, they can. If someone particularly wants to work in Italy, they can. And that we're using, you know, we're trying to use that to our advantage where we can. We like to think we're location free, but it's not quite location free. It's Italy or England.
All that hard work is paying off this year. 2026 has been going really well. At the time of this chat, 4 consecutive double points finishes. A man who's done so much racing in his life, as you have, what pleases you the most about the performances this year?
Oh, so much. You know, having competitive Saturdays and Sundays, of course, is magnificent. It's what we come here to do. Me and James Allison always used to laugh back in the day when we were working together. We used to say, how's the lump of carbon, titanium and rubber treating you? Because your mood is governed by that car at the track. And it's tragic to say it, but it really is. And I'm very conscious of the fact that we've had 4 fantastic races. There will be a point, I guess, when we don't get both cars in the points, and that will be part of my role, is to keep everyone buoyed and keep their heads up and that sort of thing. We can't catch those top 4 at the moment. They're a bit too far away. You know, I think McLaren were the closest car to us at Silverstone, and they're in the race. They're nearly a second a lap quicker than us. So to talk about Mercedes and Ferrari, they're even a bit further away. But if we can move ourselves a bit away from the Audis and the Alpines and just have a boring races, that would suit me very well.
You raise a good point about the top 4 teams, right? How far away are you from being a top 4 team? You talk about lap time, but just in terms of infrastructure and facilities, you've won world championships back in the day, right?
Yeah, but it's a very different, that was 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
So it's moved on a lot from there. I think, and I don't know, I haven't worked at McLaren, I haven't worked at Red Bull Racing or Ferrari, Mercedes, you know, but we are operating at cost cap. So we have the same kind of budget as people, but I think what those guys have done over many years of being far better funded than the other teams is their systems, their tools, that just enables them to extract more from what they have from a fixed asset, if you like, they can extract more from it. And I also think, without being unkind to anyone we have, because we have an incredibly talented group of people, the top teams, like the top football teams, they attract the best players, the best people, the best of the best are naturally going to gravitate to those top teams. And I'm very proud of what we're doing here in producing the car we're producing. It's with, I don't want to say without the top talent, because that's wrong. That does a disservice to the people we have, because we have some incredible people, but we also have some juniors that are coming through and showing their talent and growing that side of it. And you talked about drivers and engineers and are we just a junior team? Well, we're not, but it's certainly part of what we do.
Can we talk drivers then? One question I've always wondered about you guys is, why don't you just put Max in it for a test? Just to see.
You're not tempted,
or is it? What?
To see what?
I don't know, just what he makes of it, what he thinks of the car. Would that achieve anything?
No, it would just fuel you guys and your press speculation, and it would just be a massive distraction. So there's never been any talk or hint or anything like that. Look, we know where we are. we know the drivers we've got, we know the car we've got, and we're just trying to make steps every week, every time the car goes on the track, not just every weekend, every run, we're trying to improve that and do a better job. And I think we can see so far this year, we're doing that. We if we look at the metrics that we record each race, we've improved the car since Melbourne. And if we measure ourselves against the quickest cars, we are certainly in both quali pace and race pace. And race pace has been a big focus of us of the last few races. We're making improvements, and we're certainly, you know, if you go back to Barcelona, we had a very quick car in Barcelona. We got into Q3 super easy, both our cars. In fact, I think we ran one set in Q1, and against a lot of teams ran two or three sets, we were fine. We got trounced in the race. Alpine were much quicker than us in the race. So we had a little think about things. We bought some new parts to Austria and really made a big jump in Austria, and that carried through to Silverstone. And it was, some of that is some new parts that gave us some more downforce, but some of that is a little bit of a philosophy in setting the car up as well. Some of it is driving style that we spent a lot of time with the drivers. So we've certainly improved over the last couple of races our race pace.
This episode is sponsored by CarGurus. Buying a car is one of those decisions where you always end up wondering if you're making the right choice, don't you? Is it actually a good price? Has it been looked after? Am I missing something important? Looking back, I wish I'd known about CarGurus when I was last looking for a car, because rather than having to figure it all out yourself and second guess what you're looking at, CarGurus puts all the important information in one place so you can make a much more informed decision. It's the only site in the UK that shows a deal rating on every car, from great deal to overpriced. So you can quickly see whether a car is fairly priced based on its condition, mileage, and features. And it's not just the price. You can also see vehicle history, price changes, and verified dealer reviews up front, so there are fewer surprises later on. With hundreds of thousands of cars available from top-rated dealers, plus alerts for price drops and new listings, CarGurus is designed to put you in the driver's seat so you can buy your next car with confidence. Join the millions who have already found their best deal. Go to cargurus.co.uk for complete vehicle details without any surprises. That's CarGurus, CarGurus.co.uk. CarGurus.co.uk. CarGurus. Search. Buy. Sorted.
Let's talk about the two race drivers, right? Liam, first of all, what kind of a driver, what kind of a man walked through the door at Suzuka last year, right? He'd been through the ringer, hadn't he? He'd had a tough couple of races. Just what sort of condition was he in?
So he didn't really say much about it to start with, honestly. You're right, his head was down, and he won't thank me for saying this, because I think at the time he was, no, everything's fine. But you could tell, we obviously knew him from the year before, we could tell he certainly wasn't the same guy. And I don't want to say we rebuilt him, because that's a little bit dramatic, but we just supported and helped him where he could. He works incredibly hard, and he works incredibly well with his engineering team, and he did it. You know, we're there to help him, but he made a turnaround. He worked hard in the simulator. He worked hard off track and on track, and I think we saw that culminating with some really, really good performances.
And could you, with all of your experience of working with great drivers, world champions, could you say anything to him that helped him?
So what I said to him last year was, forget anything outside of this, especially after we confirmed him for 2026. I said, there's nothing that should be more important than this. Don't worry about this flight or that flight or this hotel, or you want to go here. I said, forget all that and just focus on this. And you can see that with him this year. He's definitely done that. He's laser focused, because it's a bit of a cliche, but he is. And I'm really pleased that you can see that in his driving. Honestly, he's much more aware of the car. He's much more, he works better and closer with his engineers. He knows what he wants from the car. He's able to drive it in a way to get the best out of the car. And it's something I've often said about people talk about driving style, and this driver has a particular style or that driver has a particular style. And I think the very best drivers, they don't have a style. I don't think Fernando has a driving style. I don't think Max has a driving style. I think they just drive the car however it needs to be driven to go quickest. And I think you very much saw that with Max in these previous eras that with the ground effects, and you had to have a car with a massively stiff rear end to get the best out of it, and other drivers couldn't necessarily cope with that. I think Liam is doing a little bit of that this year. He's figuring out how to drive these cars as quick as, you know, what's the best way to get everything out of this car, and he's doing that, and I think he's able to do that because he's just concentrating on driving, and he's not worrying too much about the outside world.
When it comes to the outside world, right, and social media and all these kind of things, more of a sort of philosophical question, I suppose, but do you think the Formula One environment is particularly harsh now for a young driver to come into? Because there's so much noise, way more than 20 years ago, right?
Yeah.
How tough is it?
But I guess they grow up with that, and they're part of it, aren't they? They're part of that social media. That's what they're used to. I know Liam has he says he's knocked down the head. He doesn't look at Instagram. He doesn't look at any of that stuff. He doesn't. I don't look at any of it myself. So I don't know. But I guess that's part of the distraction. Just focus on what's in front of you, what you can change, what you can affect. And he's doing that.
You make the point about being laser focused, but I remember, was it Austria last year where you guys introduced something on the car? And I remember you being very happy, actually. I bumped into you in the paddock and you were like, this has worked. What happened that weekend?
So it was a front suspension geometry that Liam and his race engineers have been working on in the simulator. And I have to say, I'm really super happy to be proved wrong, because they said, this is 2 tenths in the sim. Clear, 2 tenths. Every time we change it, he goes 2 tenths faster. Fantastic, let's put it on. But I said, honestly, it's unlikely to be, maybe I wouldn't go as far as saying forget the 2 tenths. I said it's unlikely to be 2 tenths because it's a feel thing for the driver, you know? But it was, and he loved it. He absolutely loved it. And that definitely, I don't want to say it was a turning point of his season, but I think it was a nice thing that he then felt the trust of us as well. It's something that he wanted. We said, okay, you've found this in the sim, let's do it, let's put it on the car. And it worked, and I think that was just was another step in his development. It was another step in his trust of us as well. I think
he's got a new teammate this year in Arvid Lindblad. When I mention Arvid's name to you, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
He's really pushy. Do you know what? But that's great.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he wants to do everything. He wants everything, which is how a driver should be. And I've said that to him. I said, it's great. You've got to keep that. You've got to keep, you know, pushing the engineers. You've got to find the right balance. You don't want to be too much, but driving people. And you've also got to, I think in the first few races, he's just in all areas. He's trying to understand everything. He's trying to get the maximum out of everything. And I think I said to him, you need to pick your battles, because you can't, you know, you absolutely can't be in control of the whole thing. So you need to find out where is the right areas to do. But he's certainly a guy who's not shy, who's not scared to be demanding. But I think that's good. I think we want that. We want that from a driver.
And he's bright, isn't he? We had him on the show earlier in the year.
He's super bright. But yeah. I think you have to be now. There's so much going on. That's part of being a Formula One driver these days, is intelligence, for sure.
And do you think the 26 regs lend themselves to that even more?
I don't know. There's a lot going on, but then there's always a lot going on. And drivers have always had, you know, I remember we used to talk about Sebastian and how he had such capacity. And I remember people saying from Red Bull saying to me, this guy, he can drive a lap flat out and still talk calmly on the radio and adjust switches. So I think it's always... certainly in the, let's say, the modern era, there's always been lots to do and lots to think of. Maybe there is more so now. I think that they have a lot to think about in terms of when they're not doing a quick lap. So in, if you're doing a sequence of multiple qualifying laps, when you're doing that slow lap, there's lots of things to do and think about, and getting your tyres in the right shape, getting your you know, your battery in the right levels and switches and that sort of stuff. So I think there's certainly not less this year, put it that way. All they're trying to do is still wring as much performance out of it as they can.
And how much potential has Arvid got? You've seen so many drivers. You know, you worked with Isaac last year, and I remember you being very complimentary about him. Is Arvid in the same bracket?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's early. Where are we now? He's done 9 races, so it's difficult. You know, I don't want to do him a disservice, and I don't want to create a headline where, you know, Pemain doesn't think Lindblad has the, you know, doesn't have it, but I think he has every indication he does. He certainly has the pace, and that's the thing we want, isn't it? We want all the other stuff. We want him to be good at feedback. We want him to be good with the media. We want him to be great with sponsors. We want all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, what we want more than anything is pace over single lap and race pace. And all the indications are that he has that. And I'm sure that's only going to improve.
Well, and let's go back to Melbourne, right? That points finish. And what was he, P3 on the opening lap? Did any of that surprise you? Or did you, from the moment he first drove the car, did you see that potential?
I think we've seen it. So he'd driven our car in a couple of TPCs, as we call them, testing of previous cars last year. He'd driven the Red Bull, I think, on 2 occasions on Friday and been very quick. So I don't think we had any question over his pace, honestly, and the winter testing had gone well this year. I think it was a good year to come in as a rookie. I know we talked about being a complete new formula, but we had tripled the amount of testing. So instead of 1.5 days, he got 4.5 days, which I think really helps as a rookie coming in. So no, I wasn't surprised at any of that, honestly.
And do they complement each other well, Liam and Arvid?
Yeah, absolutely. They work well together on and off. Well, let's not say on track, maybe not so well.
Alan, that's a beautiful
segue. I'm sure you're
going
to ask that one. Yeah.
I wanted to ask about, so are we going to see the competition ramping up? You know, what we saw in Austria, there was lap one at Silverstone as well, wasn't there? That they are sort of fighting over the same bit of tarmac a lot of the time,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And are the conversations after races like that difficult, awkward?
No, not at all. Absolutely not at all. And Austria was a little bit unfortunate, where Arvid honestly didn't listen to what we said. And I think it was an unfair situation on Liam. And I think if you look at that race, and I talked before about being in a boring midfield position where we don't have a challenge from behind, but we can't challenge in front. We were a little bit like that. Liam was in front of Arvid. Arvid was in front of Bortoleto. And we had enough of a gap that we just sat there and waited for Bortoleto to pit. And then as soon as we pitted Arvid, because we knew we had enough gap that Bortoleto couldn't undercut him. And we knew then we could pit Liam, because Liam had enough of a gap that Arvid couldn't undercut him. Of course, the 3 cars came out very close together, and that's when Arvid did his move, which was a bit unfortunate, honestly. But all we did is we swapped him around at the next pit stop. So it wasn't too bad. We had some words after the race. But I think it's a healthy situation to be in. They're pushing each other. Silverstone was a completely different situation to Austria. Austria we had, and I think everyone was at a similar situation. It's very hard track on brakes. It's a very hard track on tyres. We got ourselves into those 2 point scoring positions, and we didn't want to jeopardise that. We didn't want to run the, you know, inevitably if your 2 cars are fighting, they're slowing each other down, they're using their brakes more than they need to, they're using their tyres more than they need to, and we had an Audi not very far away. Silverstone was a different situation, and we'd gone into the Silverstone race saying, look, we're going to need to do a little bit of management on the medium tyres, and we said, 10 laps, let's do 10 laps of management, let's see how things are, if everything's good after that. And I said, go race each other, no problem, do it nicely and do it fairly, and I don't want to see you touching or getting penalties or anything like that, but I want you guys to be able to race. And that's what we did.
Spa this weekend, you've got a new cooling package on one of the cars, and the other one's going to get the upgrade in Hungary next week. How do you decide when you've got 2 hungry young drivers, who gets what? Who gets the new kit? Is it rock, paper, scissors? How do you work it out?
It's not quite like that. So first of all, it's very unusual for us to not bring enough kit for 2 of them. And you're right, we have 3 things here this weekend. We've got a new front brake duct, and we've got a new rear wing. That's on both cars. and then we have a new cooling pack, new bodywork and roll hoop entry. And we just couldn't do that to both cars. There just physically wasn't time to do it to both cars. So I sat down, the three of us sat down, I think it was Austria actually, maybe, I think it was Saturday after qualifying in Austria. And I said to them, look, this is the situation. We got a very decent upgrade coming to Spa, but we can only put it on one car. So there are a few options we can do. We could either delay it and you both have it in Budapest.
How seriously did you consider that?
Not at all.
What? And just out of interest, why not?
Yeah, because you want to bring your performance as soon as you can. That's the ultimate fair way to do it. Then everyone has it, but you miss out on a race and there's no way we would have done that. So that was a bit of a, and both of them said, we're not doing that, are we? And I said, no, of course we're not doing that. I said, we can flip a coin. I said, or we can make it a little bit more interesting and say, whoever's in front in Silverstone in qualifying gets the upgrade. And I think if you say in the race, there's too many variables in the race. So we said, and they both agreed. So it's a let's say it's a light-hearted way. I didn't have a preference who got it. So Arvid has it here in Spa because he was in front in qualifying in Silverstone, and Liam will have it next week. But it's a small part of the upgrade. So Liam still has a upgrade here.
I love hearing you talk about drivers, and I guess it leads me on to the sort of Helmut Marko role, right? Helmut is no longer involved in the young driver program. Are you getting more involved? Are you looking at who's coming through and sort of thinking about future seasons, who you're going to put in?
Yes, absolutely. I wouldn't say I was deeply involved in it, and Rocky looks after that and does a, you know.
So just that's Guillaume Rocky, Vettel's old engineer.
Yeah,
right,
exactly. Yeah. And he's been part of the Red Bull family for a long time, and he does an amazing job of that.
So is Rocky going to kart races and all sorts? Is that kind of how
I don't, I don't okay. know, honestly. I don't know. I'm not certainly not that far in it, but I certainly watch F3 and F2 every weekend. And we're very lucky to have an extreme talent in F2 at the moment. Nicholas Soloff is doing an amazing job. I think now he's leading the championship, but you can see after a couple of unfortunate races at the start of the year when things didn't go his way, now things have clicked. And he had the pace before, but he got punted off, or he had a failure in qualifying or something like that, but now things are going well. He's I think last week in Silverstone he won the reverse and the feature race, so and
that's going to give you a headache, isn't it?
Yeah, of course, and that's a lovely headache to have, but it's not one I'm thinking about or we're thinking about at the moment. I think we're absolutely focused on what we're doing here, and the time will come to think about drivers for next season.
Alan, it has been such a treat to catch up with you again, and it looks like you're all set for P5. what are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts, and this is what I say to, it's very dangerous to have targets like that. The target I say, and when I do this thing, when I stand up in front of people that I've told you I'm not super comfortable doing, but getting better at it, I think, is let's just target doing everything perfectly. And that's enough of a target. You know, that's, and again, to ask 800 people to operate at their perfect level is already asking a huge amount. But if we do that, then the results will look after themselves. So let's do that, and let's not worry about the position in the championship. We can worry about that later in the year. But you know, you don't change anything you're doing. You don't say, "Are we going to be P5?" Right? Let's all work a bit harder. Everyone's working.
But does it change strategy in terms of when you switch to 2027,
yes,
for example?
Quite possibly. We're in a tight battle with two other teams at the minute. Audi have a quick car, but they certainly haven't capitalized on it, and we have a very healthy points lead on them. But with Alpine, it's massively close. So I think we just need to keep doing what we're doing, and again we're still full steam ahead on this car.
Well, and you keep doing what you're doing. Do you know, how do you keep yourself motivated after? You clearly still love.
Oh my God, I love, yeah, of course.
Like more than ever, right?
I think this is season 38. So yes, of course I do. I absolutely love it. And I realise it's a massive privilege. You know, I was so excited to come here this weekend. And that, to be excited to come and do your job, I realised that is a hugely privileged position to be in, because lots of people don't have that. So I'm very, very lucky to be able to have that.
Alan, I feel like I'm sat opposite Lewis Hamilton. Lewis is saying very similar things. He, with every year that passes, he's realizing more and more how privileged he is to keep doing this. Let's talk about longevity quickly with drivers. You've worked with Fernando. When you look at his current situation, obviously it hurts.
It must be incredibly tough for him, because I know what an absolute fierce competitor he is. And for Fernando to keep getting up and still, he will be giving 100% every week, I'm very sure. So yeah, it's impressive to see that he does that. So I worked with him last, was it 21 or 22? I can't remember, in Alpine. And honestly, I didn't see any, if anything, he's just better.
He was better in 21, 22 when he was winning, than when he was winning world titles.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's he certainly hadn't lost any speed, or it didn't look to me like he'd lost any speed. Certainly in races, he was honestly devastatingly quick. He would just, it's like he didn't lose any pace from qualifying at all. He could churn out lap after lap after lap, and I think that's one of his real strengths. I've always said one of the strengths with Fernando, firstly, he doesn't have a driving style, I don't think. And that's my opinion. I've not even spoken to him about that, but I've seen him change his driving style to whatever the car needs. But I think his other strength is when he gets comfortable with a set of engineers, there's a real trust there. He'll come in after a session, he'll debrief, and then he'll disappear. And he'll let the engineers do their job, do their work, and then come back again before the start of the next session, say, okay, what have we changed? This, this, and this. Okay. And then he goes out and drives it. So there's a real lovely trust between him and engineers. And I imagine, like I say, it's been a few years since I worked with him, but that's how he was doing it in those couple of years when he was at Alpine. He was operating like that, which is impressive, I think.
Well, let's hope the car comes for him, at least to see Fernando back towards the front, right?
Yeah, let's not hope too much for that, eh? we'll take a little bit of pleasure out of his misery as well. Come on.
You've worked with so many great drivers, Raikkonens and people like that. Is Fernando still the benchmark? Is he the best you've ever worked with?
I think so, yeah. I think certainly on the engineering side, I was very fortunate to work with Michael early in my career. I was much more on the team side then. I was looking after electronics on his car back in those two championships, in the 94-95 season. That, and again, talk about privilege. You know, what a privilege to do that, to be able to say you've won two world championships with Michael Schumacher as part of that. There's a small part, but nevertheless a part of that team. But I think once I'd moved into the engineering side, Fernando is a pretty complete driver, yeah.
Alan, well, look, thank you very much for your time. It's been great to catch up. Can we do this in less than 6 years?
I think we'll have to if you want to catch me again.
Let's see.
All right, great stuff. Thank you, and good luck for the rest of the year. Thank
Thanks,
you.
Mate. Cheers.
It would be lovely to have Alan on the show again in less than 6 years' time, wouldn't it? But what a fascinating conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Alan was really interesting about many topics, but I'd have expected nothing less from a man with so much F1 experience who's currently in his 38th season of Grand Prix racing. Great insights into Liam and Arvid too, and of course, Fernando Alonso at the end there. Alan, many thanks for your time, and I'll see you again very soon. I had a brilliant chat with Arvid Lindblad on this podcast earlier in the year, so do scroll back down the Beyond the Grid feed to give that a listen, or you can watch on the F1 YouTube channel. And don't forget to enter our competition to win grandstand tickets to the Spanish Grand Prix in Madrid. You can only win if you enter. A few parish notices before I go. F1 Nation's review of the Belgian Grand Prix is out now. I'm joined by Laura Winter and Alex Brundle to reflect on Kimi Antonelli's sixth win of the season and George Russell's latest setback in the title fight. And Carlos Sainz and Gabriel Bortoleto answer your questions about Formula One on the latest episode of F1 Explains. Both of those pods are on the F1 Nation feed right now. Thanks very much for listening. I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.